Hello and welcome to Literary Loitering, the only podcast that still keeps up the shallow pretense of being about books and art.
We have a pretense?
Yes, that's what I'm here for.
Because I know we're shallow, I'm not disagreeing with the shallow part.
Yes, that's true. Graham is like the one who's here to give us like the air of respectability.
Oh wow, you're in more trouble than I thought.
Except for the weeks when Graham's not here. And then yes. It all goes wrong.
Yes, and we already know those shows are just like a pit full of howler monkeys.
Yes.
Anyway, as we've already sort of introduced, well, one of that lot's Graham, the other's Rob, and I'm Andrew.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Andrew, how is the ongoing saga of your death this week?
It's yet to reach its conclusion, which is kind of the best we can hope for.
Yes.
In case anyone's wondering...
I am literally rotting from the inside out. That's what's happening.
It's the hay fever, isn't it?
Or I mean, it sounds less impressive when you put it like that, but yes, yes, it's the hay fever.
It's a virulent... Why do they make words so hard?
Yeah, but my hay fever is almost as bad as Rob's pronunciation.
Yes.
No, I wanted to say violent, but for some reason...
Oh. You thought, let's go for the prize, go for the longer word, and then halfway through it you thought, this is why I wanted to say violent.
Yes, because virulent is the word that you use with diseases, violent isn't.
I know, you can have violent hay fever. I think that's a perfectly cromulent use of the word. I may have mentioned this before, but it blows my mind that now cromulent and embiggens have been added to the dictionary. Future generations will have absolutely no idea what the joke in that scene is.
Are they embiggening the smallest man?
Yes, which, you know, nowadays, a completely uncontroversial statement. It's in the dictionary.
God bless their noble spirits.
You'll have to footnote it like it's a Shakespeare comedy. It's quite weird to see something go from being like an accessible piece of mainstream comedy to something that requires an explanation within your lifetime.
I have no words to actually follow that up. So,
if you have no words, shall we go on to some made-up words?
Yes.
Incomprehensible.
Well, that's where we already were.
Actually, yes, that's a fair point. Rob, when you spoke earlier, were you reading out the Voynich manuscript?
No.
That's a shame, because if you were talking about the Voynich manuscript, that would have been the flukiest segue of all time. Because Stephen Skinner, an academic whose day job, and I'd love to have this as my day job, is translating the spiritual diaries of the Elizabethan mystic Dr. John Dee.
Oh,
that's the maddest job title I've ever heard.
I know.
He was a mad so-and-so.
Even by the standards of Elizabethan sorcerers, John Dee was a rummen.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, the entire history of John Dee is like a series of outtakes from Blackadder II.
That they cut out because Rowan Atkinson said, no, this is too absurd.
Yes.
Yeah, didn't he basically sort of give his wife to some weird guy he met because the weird guy he met said he'd been told to do this by angels?
Yep.
So, you know, good at the old alchemy, not so great at the doing things that make sense, I think.
I think it was because he was good at the old alchemy.
Yes.
I think the two kind of went hand in hand.
But anyway, yes, Skinner, who is John Dee's editor, again, can't get over how amazing that is.
Sorry, after what we were talking about before with this story, all I can think is, Skinner!
Yes! Yes, he claims that he has decided that the Voynich manuscript, which is a mysterious manuscript purportedly from the 15th century, written in an unknown language and full of strange botanical diagrams that has baffled and occasionally sent
people mad. I do know what that is.
Yes, yeah, it's that.
Oh, what you mean? I always knew what that was, and I didn't need you to explain it.
Yes, his evidence is pretty remarkable. In the Guardian piece I've got open here, he says, scholar draws evidence for his theory of the author's identity for a range of illustrations in the manuscript, particularly a section in which naked women are depicted bathing in pools surrounded by intestine-like pipes. The doctor believes the illustrations show communal Jewish baths called mikveh, which are still used in Orthodox Judaism to clean women after childbirth and menstruation. Skinner told The Guardian, the only place you see women like that bathing together in Europe at that time was in the purification baths that have been used by Orthodox Jews for the last 2,000 years. Mm. I think there is no other explanation for what they are. It is either rank fantasy by the author, which doesn't really fit with the medical, herbal and cosmological sections of the manuscript, or it is a mikveh.
Okay, so...
I'm quite disappointed.
Yeah.
This is a guy who edits John Dee for a living, and this is the best you could come up with.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping for a bit more.
Mm.
So this is something to do with Judaism, then?
Yeah, it's essentially, he believes it is an Orthodox Jewish herbalist's textbook.
That's kind of boring.
I'm sort of looking through it and I'm not finding a bit where he explains why this is written in gibberish.
If this is an Orthodox Jewish herbalist manuscript, isn't there like a weird picture of like a dragon or something like that?
Yeah, in fairness, there was often a mystical bent to a lot of what we would now call medical textbooks of this era.
And I don't want to know what's coming out of the dragon.
Yes.
Which, oh, actually, that explains it then, though. It's a medical textbook. And since this is kind of the days before computers or even typewriters, it was written by hand.
Yep. Mm.
And as we all know, doctors have appalling handwriting.
Yes. So this might actually be written in Latin.
It could be written in modern-day English, really. As my day job, I work in the NHS, which is not as cool as being John Dee's editor, but it does mean that I get to look at a lot of samples of doctors' handwriting. And one of the weird things is, whereas there are some of them that do have clear handwriting, none of them can write their name legibly. There are doctors who can write subdural hematoma in perfectly clear text.
Yep.
But as soon as you ask them to write their own name, it's gibberish.
So, Dr. Blue Blue Blue.
Yes.
Because that's part of the pact that they make with the great space dragon Naranathlorp. To gain their medical knowledge, that's what the book is telling us.
But the dragon keeps telling them, my name is not Naranathlorp, my name is Nigel.
The dragon, it's making me ill.
That's an impressive save.
The dragon keeps telling them, his name's not Naranathlorp, that's just how they wrote his name. His name's Nigel.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, maybe we're looking at this in too limited a perspective. Perhaps the Voynich manuscript has a picture of a dragon because it offers a cure for dragonism.
Which would be impressive.
Yeah.
And also stupid, Graham. Why would you want to cure dragonism? Gah.
I mean, I would have thought you would have understood, Andrew, as someone who sounds like he's breathing fire at the moment.
It would be nice not to be choking to death on my own lung fluid.
I was about to say, he can't be breathing fire. There's too much fluid in the way. See, I'm looking at all these pictures of the Voynich manuscript, and I'm still not seeing the Jewish herbalists bit.
Well, yeah, but then I think, how much about 15th century Jewish bathing rituals do I really know? And the answer is less than you might expect.
Actually, looking at some of these pictures, it's more like a doctor's manual. Maybe.
Well, a herbalist was essentially a doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I know my herbalist always insists I call him the doctor.
is it Peter Capaldi? Is he trying to eke out a couple more weeks before they announce his successor?
He's getting a lucrative side business going.
You say his successor, now I've just got mental images of Peter Capaldi sitting on a throne made out of TARDISes.
Yes, which, that would be good. They should do that.
And he's making the prospective heirs fight to the death.
Take that, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. You have been slew by Chris Marshall.
No, you're all wrong, because the next Doctor's going to be Christopher Eccleston.
I was about to say, he could be sitting there going, where's that Eccleston fella? I liked him.
What a twist. I have made the horrible mistake of reading the comments on the Guardian site, and you might find yourself wondering, I wonder if there are loads of mad comments from people who have their own personal theory about the Voynich manuscript.
Oh, and I'm glad about who the next Doctor is.
Yes. Well, the Voynich manuscript does have a prediction of who all the Doctors will be.
Oh?
No, it doesn't.
I was going to say, I was hoping for something tasty there.
Of course it doesn't.
No, I bet there's an entire page just filled with the word Idris Elba.
Yes. But it's all in code, so we don't actually know.
But it does have a massive picture of Idris Elba washing himself in a ritual Jewish bath. Worryingly spicy stuff, this Voynich manuscript. Yeah, the comments are full of people with their own mad thoughts on who did it, including one from the subtly named Voynich Solution, who writes, "What expert does he want to be? No translation, no solved code. But theories. The manuscripts were not written in Italy. The manuscript was not written by any Jew. The drawings do not refer to Jewish thought. In the manuscript itself, it is written that there are several authors. I've been working on the translation since 2007, thinking, all right, so what's your evidence that it is not written in Italy? It is written in Latin. Ah, yes, that famous non-Italian language. Carry on."
I've just got to say, if he's been working on the translation for 10 years, he's not doing a very good job of it, is he?
Yeah, I'd expect him to have shown solid results by now.
Exactly.
Imagine bumping into that guy at parties. Well, so what do you do? Well, you know, I've been spending the last decade of my precious life trying to translate a manual written in an unknown language. Oh, why have you done that? I hate myself.
My theory now, I'm changing my theory. I'll come up with more theories after this, but my current theory is that it is basically someone went back in time and what century was the Voynich manuscript from? 15th, was it?
Yeah, that's the theory.
It's the 15th century version of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
That would be very cool. I mean, I'm looking at this picture of the women bathing in what, according to Simon Skinner, is a Jewish ritual bath. And they do seem to be doing the can-can. Not the can-can, sorry, the conga.
Oh, right. Better than the Lambeth Walk.
Yeah, it's definitely got a sort of formation dance feel to it.
I bet there's a page that, when translated, reads, "I'm never going to give you up, never going to let you down."
Is it the page with the dragon on it?
Yeah.
Yes, that would be wonderful if the Voynich manuscript was actually the world's oldest rickroll.
Maybe that's the dragon's name. The dragon's real name.
Yeah, that seems plausible. So, we've got Vic Astley the dragon. Should we move on to something that can only make more sense than that?
Yes, something that actually makes a lot of sense. And I'm really happy about this because I hope more libraries do the same thing. It's kind of long overdue, I suppose. City of Sydney, and for those people who are geographically challenged, Sydney is in Australia. No, it's
well,
not the capital city.
We're aiming low this week, aren't we?
Trump's in Europe. he's only just discovered. I mean, most Americans don't know where Europe is.
Yeah, that's true. I imagine Donald Trump's still kind of confused about the matter.
It's in Switzerland, right?
Yes, which is in Africa.
Did you see the BBC doing a... was it the BBC? Yeah, it was the BBC. They were doing this weird breakdown of the body language of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin when they met.
Right.
And I was just sitting there going, this is one of the most surreal things BBC have come up with. You've got some woman talking about Donald Trump and how he's sitting and Vladimir Putin, apparently he's meek in front of Donald Trump. And they're thinking, this is a guy who wrestles bears. He's not going to be meek in front of Donald Trump. He's probably sitting there thinking, who is this clown?
Yeah, when can I go home?
When can I start World War III? I'm going to win easy.
I mean, there has been all of this talk about how, oh, it's Trump and Putin's first meeting. And I'm thinking, yeah, let's wait till the FBI investigation's over before we say that for deafness.
Yes. But anyway, the city of Sydney, back to the news, they have scrapped library fines after a trial, you know, a test period, have shown everybody something that everybody already knew. Reminders work better. If you send out a reminder to somebody that their book is overdue, or their book is going to be overdue tomorrow, they'll make the effort to bring it back.
That's disarmingly sane, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't like it. What's the twist?
The twist is that it's so logical, I'm amazed that nobody thought of it before. Especially given technology the way it is right now, where you can get reminders to your smartphone.
Well, yeah. So that's solved all of libraries.
Although, has it? Because I feel like maybe in the spirit of the having to explain where Sydney is, should we maybe tell the audience what a book is?
Yes, yeah, let's do that. Go on.
A book is that thing that you always avoid.
Basically, a dead tree that we have scrawled arcane symbols on.
That's, yeah. In fact, I should put that forward as the explanation to the Voynich manuscript.
Have you noticed how none of us have said a book is a collection of knowledge that has been written down for future generations because we've read some utter trash?
Yes. Yeah, it's all very well saying, you know, the book is a fine and noble thing, but then you start reading Ayn Rand.
Never mind Ayn Rand.
I don't, to be honest.
The Da Vinci Code, mate.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose when you've just been discussing the Voynich manuscript, you're not in the mood to make fun of Dan Brown because you're starting to feel a bit Dan Brown.
No, I don't want to feel Dan Brown. Never. You can't make me.
What is Dan Brown's explanation for the Voynich manuscript?
Oh, I'm sure there's a book coming about that.
Oh, there has to be. I mean, there's going to be like the Vitruvian Man, and then there's going to be horses, and then there's going to be pyramids. There's going to be a chase scene and an underwater scene, and then there's going to be the most depressing kind of alchemy elemental diamond thing that he. I mean, it was just like four words written down in like a square. That's not a twist.
I mean, it sounds bad, but I have to admit, if he was an African woman, I'd be saying it was brilliant.
Yeah, but...
I'd be saying it was brilliant if all of Dan Brown's books were just like a single page was with John Dee did it.
And also probably more factually accurate, too.
Yes, this is true.
Yes.
I would enjoy Dan Brown's books more if the bits in between the covers, which are, you know, very nice, would be hollowed out completely and replaced by Gravity's Rainbow.
See, I might have enjoyed The Da Vinci Code more if right at the beginning he wrote, I didn't have the talent to write something like Foucault's Pendulum, so I stole a bunch of his ideas, Umberto Eco's ideas, and wrote this instead.
Completely, yes, that is so true. Didn't Umberto Eco actually say that he is convinced that Dan Brown is a character from one of his novels who came to life?
Yes.
Brilliant.
I loved him. So anyway, yes, the Lord Mayor of Sydney. That's the most amazing name, by the way.
Oh?
The Lord Mayor of Sydney is called Clover Moore.
Wow.
Yeah. Said fines often had a detrimental effect and frightened borrowers into never returning overdue items. This new approach encourages positive community responsibility and sharing rather than penalising people.
good work, Clover Moore.
Yeah, and she's, you know, she's leading the charge with this, and I hope other cities, other libraries actually take this into consideration and change the way they do things. Because she's right, you know, once you get that fine, once you get the overdue fine, you think, I just won't bother taking it back. I'll just say it's lost. Or something like that. Or I just won't go back to that library ever again.
Yeah, it's the thug life thing. Once you start down that path, there's no turning back.
Yep.
So, do you think there are other crimes where we could profitably, like, just replace punishment with a little reminder?
Yes.
Murder?
No. Not that one.
I think murder needs at least a stern shaking of the head.
Yeah.
Maybe a waggle of the finger as well.
All right. We're not a Law and Order podcast. That's, so what ones would we do?
Barratry.
I don't even know what that is.
Barratry is basically where you sink your own ship to steal the cargo.
Wow. That's... What? How is there a word for that?
Don't ask me how I know that word. I don't even remember where I learned that from.
Blimey.
Just a gentle reminder, don't do this. You're on a ship. You still need to get home.
You cannot walk along the seabed.
This is not Pirates of the Caribbean. So, yeah, I'd say Barratry would be my top pick.
Actually, can we just have little reminders on all the crimes? Just kind of little notifications to probably say, are you sure you've cleaned all the blood?
Yes.
That witness has seen your face. You know what to do.
Have you removed all...
Also, just to clarify, this is like Clippy the Clip Art thing that's saying all of this.
Yeah. Have you removed all the fingerprints or found a convenient koala?
It looks like you're about to commit grand larceny. Would you like some help with that?
Did you bring gloves? If not, I can direct you to the nearest zoo with koalas. Now, did you know koalas are the only other animal that has, like, unique fingerprints?
Yes, completely. Yeah.
So if you wanted to throw them off your scent, you just bring a koala?
But what if, it says koalas have unique fingerprints, but I assume that means compared to other koalas. The koala might, through an extraordinary twist of fate, have the same fingerprints as you. I think I've just written James Patterson's next novel.
Oh my god, Killer Koala.
Yes.
It's going to happen now, you said it. James Patterson, you are not allowed to steal Graham's idea.
Unless, of course, you get me to write it like you normally do, because you're such a lazy turd.
So, if we're making suggestions, I want a scene where the koala, like, goes on the run to prove his own innocence, and in one scene he gets confronted by US Marshal Tommy Lee Jones.
Is it going to be a scene where he's talking about the average foot speed of a koala?
And then the koala says, I didn't kill my koala wife. And Tommy Lee Jones just yells, I don't care. And then the koala kind of backflips off waterfall.
The koalas keep saying, it was a one-armed koala that did it.
Yeah, this all seems pretty legit.
Anyway, leaving that to one side, the Oxford English Dictionary.
We love some dictionary stories, don't we?
Yeah, their latest online update has added a clutch of new terms describing tennis, some of which date back to the 16th century.
Now, like most people, when you say tennis to me, I naturally think about the bitchin' American duo of the same name. But I understand there are other definitions to tennis that might be of interest to people who don't know Sydney is in Australia.
Yes. How do I describe this, right? Well, we know some of them. Superbrat, for example, was McEnroe, wasn't it?
Mm, yeah.
You know, changeover is one that's commonly used, forced error. Some of the lesser known ones are things like bagel, which is a visual pun to describe the score in a set of six games to love. The zero apparently looks like a bread roll.
Yes, yeah. It does.
It yeah. also looks like a zero.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the tennis mom or dad, which is, I suppose, tennis equivalent of the soccer mom or soccer mom. Dad.
Yeah.
What? When did they, what, whoa, whoa, whoa.
This is good.
Oh, no. The terms were added with the help of the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club. When did they add the croquet?
Needed to diversify their hobbies a bit.
When are we going to get croquet at Wimbledon? It's such a gripping sport.
I like croquet. It's one of the few sports that I've ever been, like, competent at.
I don't mind a bit of croquet, but it's just, I don't know.
I like croquet because it means I can carry around a mallet and no one asks questions.
True. If you're wearing a beige cardigan and carrying a mallet.
There's a croquet game at the start of Heathers, so the croquet violence link is...
True.
Let's all say that that was what I was going for.
I don't know why they've added all these definitions for tennis. The word tennis itself comes from the old French word tennis, which literally means take or receive.
Oh, wow, that's a more racy game of tennis than I'm used to.
Exactly. I'm not sure why they've suddenly decided to add all these tennis things. I think it's just the effect of Wimbledon and the fact that Andy Murray is the world number one and two-time Wimbledon champion.
Or they got bored. A lot of decisions, you know, that the dictionary makes could be explained by saying they just got bored, couldn't they?
Yeah. Their new update also included other words from other fields. Like post-truth.
Of course, yes, you'd have to.
Walk, which was a word of the year. It was shortlisted as a word of the year for 2016. It was popularised by the Black Lives Matter movement to signify being alert to racial and social discrimination and injustice.
Yes.
Academise.
I don't know that one.
It was education and government policy for state schools to convert into independently run academies. It's called Academise.
Oh, never heard it referred to that way before. That's interesting.
So if they decide to only serve soda at lunch break, is that sodomise? Where does it end?
Superb work there, I think. I think that's the best pun we've ever done.
No, it's the best pun I've ever done.
No, it's the best pun humanity has yet achieved.
Son of a bachelor, which is the alternative expression to son of a bitch, which apparently is deemed both misogynistic and offensive, even though the term itself refers to you being the son of a female dog. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the correct term for a female dog was bitch, wasn't it?
Yes. I don't think the term
bachelor
is...
No, you gender Nazi.
Daring position, defend it.
I really wanted to say the term gender Nazi because I think it's funny.
I was kind of lost because it came out of left field.
Mm.
I was sitting there thinking, I need to come back. What can I say?
I mean, I felt like it was time for me to make an important contribution to this discussion.
It was pretty vital. I mean, it was no sodomized, but it was pretty good.
I mean, that's it, really. The sodomized thing has got me feeling defensive. Because Rob's not supposed to make puns that are that good.
Yeah, I know.
If they can do that, then what's the point of me? Why do I exist?
It's because I'm freshly showered. I'm clean for a change. So I'm actually cool. I'm not overheating in this room.
Ain't nobody dope as you. You're just so fresh and so clean.
I think I've solved my overheating problem because about halfway through the shows, because it gets so hot in this tiny box room where the studio is, my brain starts overheating.
Do not announce to the general public that you've only just worked out that you need to have a wash.
No, I just need to dunk my head in a basin of cold water before we record.
Ah, right.
That's my solution. Because then I've got like a wet head that's cooling for the next hour.
So being cool makes you get less hot. That is possibly the scientific breakthrough of the century.
Yes.
Should we move on from this rubbish?
Yes, onto completely different rubbish.
Yes.
This is a free podcast that I think people should demand a refund for. Well, yes, this is complete nonsense coming up here too, though.
It is, it is. So, shall we take a break there?
I hope we've got more. Yes, yeah. Yes, let's.
TV. There's a lot of TV. Even the internet is TV these days. And if there's too much out there to know what to watch and what not to watch, well, tune in to the Geek Show Podcast Network's very own TV show, On The Box.
Hi, and welcome back. We've taken Rob back behind the sheds and beaten the funny out of him, so now everything can get back on track.
Yes, we have. What should we do first, the review or the quiz?
Do the review first.
I was going to say review.
Yeah, I said do the review first.
Oh, right, okay. Let's do the review first.
Right, okay, so I've got the sequel to Warlock Holmes, A Study in Brimstone, which is Warlock Holmes, The Hellhound of the Baskervilles by G.S. Denning, which is out from Titan Books. And I've got to say, it's an improvement on the first book. I think by the time G.S. Denning put pen to paper for the sequel, probably a bit more familiar with the character and with how they wanted to approach these individual stories. Because, again, like the first book, it's a series of shorter stories that are based heavily on Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories.
Well, plus, I think once you've come up with the title The Hellhound of the Baskervilles, the only way is up.
Yep. The stories in this are The Adventure of the Blackened Barrels, Silver Blaze, Murder House, The Re-Gateway to Another World, The Adventure of the Solitary Tricyclist, and The Hellhound of the Baskervilles. And for those of you who are very familiar with Arthur Conan Doyle's work, you can probably figure out which of the Sherlock Holmes stories those relate to, and you wouldn't be too far wrong. But when we last left Warlock Holmes, he was kind of dead and not dead at the same time. And Watson was surprised to find that Warlock's arch-nemesis Moriarty had basically taken over the living, dead, undead body of Warlock Holmes. So Watson now is in a bit of a tiz, because no one knows what's happened to Warlock Holmes. He's managed to convince everybody that he's gone on holiday, he's doing other things, he's busy with his work and things like that. And he's basically filled 221B Baker Street with flowers to cover up the smell of rotting corpse.
Nice.
Yeah. The stories then continue with investigations. There's various things that happen. There's a not-so-peaceful amble around the Surrey countryside. Very, very strange tricycle race in Farnham. Things like that tend to happen. But it's all kind of tongue-in-cheek, and The Hound of the Baskervilles is obviously the story that everyone would want to read from this book, because The Hellhound of the Baskervilles, because The Hound of the Baskervilles is kind of it's the Sherlock Holmes story. It's the one that everyone knows, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was kind of important that G.S. Denning got that one right, and thankfully he has done. The story is actually quite fun to read. There are little blips here and there, but I'm not really going to dwell on those, because overall, it's actually quite enjoyable. It's not highbrow entertainment in the slightest. I wouldn't put it in the same category as, say, Pratchett in terms of comedy. What was his name? Who wrote Porterhouse Blue?
Tom Sharp.
Tom Sharp, yeah. It's a bit more Tom Sharp in terms of its humour. Or it tries to be, anyway. It's a bit more Tom Sharp when he was writing Wilt than it is Tom Sharp writing Porterhouse Blue. G.S. Denning, like I said, seems to be more comfortable with the characters by this point, and that kind of shows in the characters seem to be more relaxed, or the writing style seems to be more relaxed. And it doesn't seem as forced with a lot of its humor, with a lot of its action. It is structurally the same as the Arthur Conan Doyle stories, broadly speaking. But again, there is that twist that all the Arthur Conan Doyle stories are actually written by John Watson, and John Watson was writing those stories to hide the truth of what happened, because the truth of what happened was highly magical in nature.
Yeah.
So overall, I mean, it is homesploitation at its, would I say strangest? No. I'd say most tongue-in-cheek. Do you guys remember that Michael Caine movie, Without a Clue?
Yes, yeah.
It's a bit...
I do not.
You do not? Okay. It's a bit more like that in terms of its approach to Sherlock Holmes, to John Watson, basically to everything. And I'll be honest, it'd be interesting to see like a televised version of this, to see how it stands up. I think they could make it work. And it is the kind of thing that, especially as they did Pride, Prejudice and Zombies, didn't they?
Yes, that's true.
You know, didn't they make a movie out of that or something?
They did, and you're the sole person who remembers that fact.
Yep, and if they can make a movie out of that, then they could probably make a TV series out of this.
Hmm.
And I'd be more willing to watch a Sherlock Holmes TV series than watch Pride, Prejudice and Zombies.
Yes.
Yes, because that movie is probably not a shining example of what you can do with the genre.
No, it isn't. I think I got through 10 minutes of it and then just went, nope.
It's got a weirdly good cast, though, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, hasn't it? It's got Lily James and Matt Smith and a lot of people who don't really have to be in a movie called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
See, I reckon...
It also has an appalling waste of Lena Headey, though.
Yeah. I reckon it was the producer, whoever you are, he probably called in all his favours, or her favours.
Yes.
We need to get this movie made. It's my favourite book in the whole world. In fact, it's the only book I've read in the whole world.
Sometimes you can just encapsulate someone's life in one depressing sentence, and I think his favourite book was Pride, Prejudice and Zombies would be pretty depressing.
Yes. Yes, I agree. But yeah, that's Sherlock Holmes, the Hellhound of the Baskervilles. I'm keeping it short and sweet because at the end of the day, it's the kind of thing that is very easy to spoil, especially if you're familiar with Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to go into the stories themselves because too easy to spoil.
So I've been looking forward to a new quiz for a while, and I think I found an option.
Oh?
Just recently, we were talking about how we love the diagram prize, right?
Yes. It's one of our two highlights of the year.
Yeah, I think we all know the other one. Yes. And we were wondering whether they still do it. It didn't seem to have been carried out recently. I'm pleased to announce that the 5-book shortlist for this year's Diagram Prize has been announced.
Ooh.
And I have a Guardian article in front of me that explains all of the books and what they're about. But rather than explain what they're about, I'm going to read out the titles and have you guys come up with what the books are about.
Sounds good. Let's do this. So, game on, Andrew. I'm going to win this one.
Yes. I haven't thought at all about how I would award points for this. So it's just going to be... It's going to be like shooting stars. I'm just going to decide what I like more.
Andrew's going to win now. He always wins.
My plan was just ignore whatever happens and build myself a cardboard crown with the winner, but like with one N and the R is backwards on it.
So, in ascending order of ridiculousness, we have a book by Peter Andrews, and it is called An Ape's View of Evolution.
Hmm.
I mean, I assume this is finally Professor Bobo T. Chimpanzee is going to offer his rebuttal to Charles Darwin's On the Origin of the Species.
Yeah, in which Bulbul claims that, in fact, apes were always the superior race, and if anything, humans have devolved.
See, I thought it was going to be the novelization of the New Planet of the Apes trilogy.
Perhaps. In actual fact, it is described by who is it in fact? It is described by the bookseller's diarist Horace Bent as a classic diagram, a sober and worthy academic tone, which is unintentionally humorous. It brings me back to previous winners like that 2000s Designing High Performance Stiffened Structures,
yes,
or 1993's American Bottom Archaeology.
Yes, that's still the best title.
It is spectacular. So next up, we have Michaela Giles with her book, The Commuter Pig Keeper.
Is this something to do with mobile farms? So you can take your farm with you wherever you go, to the office, to the gym.
Yeah, you can mount a farm now on the handlebars of your bike. It's like everything else. They're just getting smaller as technology improves.
Yeah, because you can get those tiny pigs now, can't you? Like teacup pigs and stuff like that. So you could have your own farm. It just like in a little box that you take with you everywhere.
It sounds like it would be one of those really disappointing kids things that they had in the 50s and 60s, like Sea Monkeys or something, where they sell you, your instant life, your fantastic ant farm, and you get it and you realise this is actually the most boring thing in the whole of human existence.
But this is a real actual farm, so you've got you've got real pigs, and you know they're real pigs because one of them has eaten your finger. you got tiny little chickens, and they just won't shut up. They keep clucking all the time.
This sounds like a David Lynch script, to be honest.
Which, speaking of alternative interpretation of this title, it's a very Hannibal-esque. Turns out the best way to raise pigs is actually to feed them on a steady diet of commuters.
Yeah, there's that option as well.
I like that.
Although tiny little pigs in a teacup. I'm sorry, but that's cute.
Yeah.
But I do love the idea of saying, hold on a sec, I just need to check on my pig farm, and then kind of opening up your jacket pocket.
Yes. Just pop the briefcase open. Ah, yeah, they're fine. Yes.
So what is it actually there, Graham?
The Commuter Pig Keeper is, according to the blurb, a comprehensive guide to keeping pigs when time is your most precious commodity. Previous winners that this has been compared to are 2000's The Big Book of Lesbian Horse Stories and 2012's Goblin Proofing One's Chicken Coop.
Which I actually have a copy of.
No way.
Seriously. Andy got us a couple of copies of it. I've still got it here, if you guys want to read it.
I've never read a Diagram Prize winner, and now you've said it, I think, why was that not already on my bucket list?
Wait, what are you going to do, Graham? Build chicken coops that aren't goblin-proof? You amateur.
I have been having a terrible problem with goblins stealing all of my chickens recently. Now I know why.
All I can say is that Greek rule post offices and their cancellation numbers, that's
superb.
There's really no plot there.
You're not gripped by the suspense of finding out what each cancellation number is.
No, the action was kind of lackluster, and the ending was disappointing.
Sex scenes were white hot, though.
Oh, yeah. Imaginary. Totally imaginary.
Blistering postman on postman's action.
Basically, yes.
I've got a package to deliver, etc., etc. Look, we all know someone had to say it.
We just left the door open for you, Andrew.
Which is also a line from one of the roasting hot sex scenes in Greek Ruval Postman and their cancellation numbers.
Yes. Next up then. Next.
Next is a book edited by Ian McConnelly called, and this is a dangerously cryptic title, I think. Good luck with this. Rennick's Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors, the Premier Guide for Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors.
What?
Seriously, that's it.
It's the erotic thriller of the day.
It's... Yeah. I mean, I always thought Greek Ruble Postman and their cancellation numbers sounded like it would be some sort of tricksy postmodern novel by, like, I don't know, David Foster Wallace or Don DeLillo. Maybe this is the same.
Maybe it's the new Slaughterhouse Five. We don't know.
Maybe. Or maybe, as the publisher of Rennick's Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors, the Premier Guide for Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors, the book is a must-have for all Australian coin error collectors.
Okay, when they say coin errors, are they talking about misprints on coins? Are they talking about something completely different?
I assume they talk about misprints on coins. I'm not sure you can make many other collectible errors with a coin.
And so it's pre- and post-decimal errors. So they have Imperial system coins that were wrong, even though the Imperial system itself is kind of wrong.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe this entire book is just one page with just all of them.
All errors. There is no right with decimal and pre-decimal coins in Australia. Who is the mysterious Rennick's, too? That's what I want to know.
What it's about is pretty obvious, because it's in the title. But I'm deeply, deeply concerned about anybody who thinks this is a fascinating book.
Actually, that's the... Grim, who did you say wrote this again?
It only has an editor's credit. Edited by Ian McConnelly.
Ian McConnelly, seek help.
Well, just PSA to all our audience. If you meet Ian McConnelly at a party, run.
Either that or throw a coin error in his direction, then run.
Yes. Hand him a completely normal coin and say, can you spot the error on that? And he will become so absorbed in it that you can make your getaway.
Oh my God, isn't that like feeding his addiction? Eventually he's going to be wandering around going, hey mate, you got 20p?
Yes. Maybe that's what, you know, all those people who ask me for change in Middlesbrough are doing. Maybe there's no poverty at all. There's just a lot of people who are interested in pre-decimal and decimal coin errors.
No, I think you'll find that they're just pre-decimal and decimal errors. Those people are.
Right.
That is an in rouge way of dealing with it.
Yes.
So number four.
Yes.
Number four is by Lisa Lister, and it has a title I'm sure will lend itself to nothing but the most wholesome speculation. Love Your Lady Landscape.
Wow! They finally released a compilation of all the top female gardeners in the UK. That's what I've been waiting for all my life.
Oh...
Charlie Dimmock, Kim Wilde, all of the other ones.
Alan that's two more than I could have named.
What would I guess this as? I don't know. A book on vajazzling.
That is worryingly close to the truth. Its subtitle apparently encourages the reader to trust your gut, care for down there, and reclaim your fierce and feminine she, which I assume the first novel by H. Rider Haggard.
Hang on, did I just score a point? Are we doing
probably
points?
I haven't been taking notes. See, if I was awarding points for successfully guessing what the book is about, I think you both have a point for Rennick's Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors, the Premier Guide for Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors.
Yep.
But would you get the final book shortlisted? by Graham and Deborah Robertson. Nipples on My Knee.
Oh, yeah, that's an easy one.
Right.
It's obviously the official novel continuation of David Cronenberg's The Fly.
No, sorry, you're wrong. It's Videodrome.
See, I was going to go with it's the continuation of D.H. Lawrence's The Rainbow, because that has eyes on the breast. Oh, eyes instead of nipples. So the nipples must have moved somewhere else to a different part of the body.
That's very true. And the eyes are kneecaps. It's all swapping round.
Yes, exactly. It's like a Picasso.
Yes. Nipples on My Knee.
It's something to do with milking, I'm guessing.
It's what, sorry?
Something to do with milking. Milking cows.
Oh, wow, Rob, you're actually worryingly close there. It's a memoir of 25 years in the sheep business.
Oh, God.
Graham and Deborah Robertson,
no,
I think...
No, I'm sorry. This book is immediately disqualified. You're writing a book about years in the sheep business, and you don't go with, thank you for all the memories. What the actual hell?
But then you wouldn't get a Diagram nomination.
I don't care. That's the kind of, you've got to go with a sheep pun. It's the law.
Well, before Andrew started to mutton in there.
Oh, that was horrible.
Yes, Graham and Deborah Robertson, having written a book called Nipples on My Knee, and not really sort of fighting against my perception of them as being a bit creepy, they say that readers should, and I quote directly, sit back in front of the fireplace on a cold, snowy evening, perhaps with a glass of sherry, while we relate to you our experiences.
Andrew, one man and his dog just took a creepy turn.
I think they're doing this deliberately to get nominated for a Diagram Prize. It's terrible. They're pulling the wool over all our eyes. All our eyes, which are like attached to our breasts.
Yes.
And our knees and everything like that. Oh.
I don't know. I don't know why you're complaining. I think it sounds mint sauce.
Oh, that's awful. That's awful.
So I've totted up the points, and it turns out the winner is the late film director and restaurant critic Michael Winner. It's in his name. What can I say? Them's the rules.
Oh, sorry, now I'm just remembering all those really horrible adverts he did.
Yes.
Calm down, dear.
His face just went bright red and he just looked pained.
Yes.
In fairness, that was Michael Winner's standard facial expression.
This is true. So, we're at the end of the show. All of our shows are available on iTunes and Audioboom or the podcast provider of your choice. So if you're listening through any of those, then subscribe and it'll keep you up to date with all of our latest shows. Literary Loitering is part of the Geek Show podcast network, and there's other shows on the network. So explore the network and find something that you like. We have all sorts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, or email us studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. And that's it. That's all the info dump out of the way. So, anything else, guys? Anything else to do?
Yes, I think all my internal organs have liquefied.
Okay.
Excellent.
So, that's it for this week. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more Strange Tales of Derring Do and other stuff. Andrew may be alive at that point.
I mean, don't get the hopes up, Rob.
So, yeah, until then, I've been Rob.
I've been Graham.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.